You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, we'll be assessing Europe's handling of terrorism with reports of a mass shooting taking place in Munich just a few hours ago. Is it time for a reappraisal of the continent's approach? Well, my guests will be Monocle's Stephen Bluefield and also Tom Edwards, who will be discussing this and the other week's big stories, including Turkey. We'll also be looking back at a week of uncertainty in that nation following Friday's failed military coup.
Lots of scenes of panic, especially on major infrastructure like bridges, and people are also trying to work out exactly what's going on in terms of the government's control of power here at the moment.
Then we'll be asking why the UK's multi-billion pound nuclear submarines are bumping into boats in the Med. And we'll also be perusing the art collection of David Bowie with Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, welcome to Midori House, and my guest today are Monocle's executive and foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, and Monocle 24's executive producer, Tom Edwards. Now, just before we came on air, there were reports of a mass shooting in Munich, with reports potentially of one death, according to AFP, and multiple other injuries. The scene is unfolding, but we believe there was a single shooter. Steve, first of all, perhaps I could come to you. Mm. You've been looking at the news, what it's saying in German media. What's the story so far?
So this happened at a shopping centre near the Olympic Stadium in Munich. There are conflicting reports, but the police sources have said there is at least one person dead and 10 people injured. And again, there are conflicting reports. I mean, this has literally happened within the past hour. Some people saying the incident is over, some people saying it is still ongoing. Obviously, people in the Munich area are told to not go anywhere near where it's happening. That's pretty much all we know so far, and anything else would be speculation.
As we say, Steve, anything else would be speculation. We can't even say this is definitely a terrorist attack at this time.
No.
Well, we're going to move on now because, interestingly, we were going to start today talking about how Germans felt about the security in their country and whether they could be a target of terrorism. And this, of course, follows on from the Nice attacks last week. There's a sense that the growing spectre of terrorism looming over the news landscape has been, well, not always well told. We are, of course, referring to the horrific attacks involving a lorry in Nice 8 days ago, which killed 84 people, and also the knife and the axe attack on a German passenger train that followed earlier this week. Well, just as we've gone to air, as we said, there have been reports of another attack in Munich. Steve, first of all, could we just come to the reporting of these incidents? Now, it's a very sensitive issue, but at the beginning of the week when we had the German train attack, it was very slow for details of the nationality of the attacker to come out. It was revealed that he was a teenager. It was revealed where the attack had happened, how many people were injured. But it seemed to be a delay of some hours before it was acknowledged that it was an Afghan migrant. Was that, do you think, a sensitivity on the part of the Germans, who have in the past been overcautious about revealing any of this information? And if, in fact, even the police have gone, you know, against the will of the people, it feels, and held back this information? Or do you think that's right, that you just have to wait quite a long time to confirm these details?
I think you need to be careful. But I think, you know, if we look back to the incident in Cologne on New Year's Eve, where a lot of the reporting about what was, you know, hundreds of men, mainly, as it turns out, from North Africa. And we've got an interview with the mayor of Cologne where she talks about this in some detail coming up in the new issue of Monocle in the September issue. The initial reporting on that, hardly any of it actually mentioned the nationalities of those involved, in a way that made it suggest that this was somehow something that shouldn't be talked about. We should sort of ignore this as if this isn't actually an issue. And actually, as the mayor of Cologne says in this interview that we've done with her, you know, their nationality, their background was an issue. That was, she believes, part of the reason why these incidents had taken place. So I understand the need to be careful at times, but I don't think there's a problem with, for example, pointing out that the person that carried out the attack in Germany was Afghan, or that the person that carried out the attack in Nice had dual French-Tunisian nationality. These are, you know, this is part of the story.
Tom, you're running a news agenda here on Monocle 24, and much of the criticism has been of radio stations like us, of people saying the liberal media has deliberately not covered many of the kind of elements of the story. We had a very different story here in the UK in recent years, which was attacks on young white girls, grooming, raping by a group of Pakistani men. And again, there was a feeling that it went on for many, many years because people in institutions were too kind of passive, too liberal to kind of point out that there may be a problem in some parts of a community, and even that was too difficult to point out. Do you think that actually the liberal media have in some instances done a disservice to this whole story, because then that just feeds this kind of right-wing kind of backlash?
Well, I think that's absolutely right, Andrew, and I think there's something almost paradoxical about this, which is that I'm sure a well-intentioned bid to for example, not offend political correctness and not make a situation that might be quite incendiary worse, sometimes maybe prompt certain media outlets to self-censor to a degree. Now, far from maintaining a sense of order and stopping the rhetoric from becoming more inflamed, I think it has the opposite effect. And in many ways, if that self-censorship happens, it actually affords more of an opportunity to people who want to spout populist, nationalist rhetoric. It offers up an opportunity to those on the right who are seeking to often make political capital out of instances of this sort to do that more effectively. I think that's the problem. The irony is that the very thing people are perhaps worrying about is made more easy.
For example, look at the incident in Norway with Anders Behring Breivik. His political views were vital to the telling of the story. If you hadn't talked about the fact that he was a neo-Nazi, this would, how on earth would you tell that story without talking about his politics and his background?
We're going to cross over in 1 second just to Tyler Brulé, editor-in-chief. But Steve, you've just been following the news there. Have there been any updates on the attack yet from the German media?
Nothing that I would like to repeat, because at the moment it is all speculation. We've got another 22 minutes of the program, and if it changes, obviously I'll bring you up to speed, but there's nothing so far that has been confirmed by more than one source.
And we will be bringing you up to date at the top of the hour with all our news bulletins during the evening as well. Let's cross over to Tyler Brulé, who's in Südtirol in northern Italy today. Tyler, it's interesting. We talked earlier in the week about having a discussion around the reporting of terrorism, the nature of terrorism, and what needs to be done. And here we are again on a Friday evening discussing potentially attack. We don't know if it's terrorism, but the framework is out there. We're back in this cycle. What's your take on this reporting side of it, first of all, how we've been dealing with the story and how we've been giving information to people?
Well, I think there are two sides, and good evening, gentlemen, by the way. I think that there is a German, state story that needs to be told as well, because perhaps more than almost any other country, for reasons that would be familiar, maybe unfamiliar to others as well, when you have attacks of this nature today, and of course, we only have to rewind to Monday to see the attacks and the attack in northern Bavaria as well. I was quite surprised watching that, because traditionally, the framework is that a story like this, German media is very, very careful. They don't release names, and they do want to sit on things. German newsrooms are quite used to censoring. There is definitely self-censorship in newsrooms, and oftentimes you do see a complete news blackout. So this is part of, or at least one part of German media culture. And then, of course, it is up to the editor of the day when there's not a blackout, you know, how much do they want to tell? How much is in the public's interest at a certain point? I was quite surprised when we saw the Interior Minister of Bavaria very, very early on in the story. And I think this goes back a little bit to maybe even lessons learned to what Steve was saying. Does this serve the, at this point, the state interest of Bavaria, the national interest of Germany to be sitting on this, when we've already seen so many elements, very, very simple things, which have, of course, not just inflamed debate, but they've incensed neighborhoods, where there is this, whether it's on one side self-censorship, Andrew, or it's this kind of pre-guessing thinking, and you know, one instance that, of course, we were talking about a little bit at the start of the year was the ban on fireworks, because, you know, communities were told they couldn't, German communities were said in many parts of the country that you can't have fireworks because this might upset new arrivals. Now, of course, everyone can understand that, the trauma that people have been through, but at the same time, to then impose a blanket ban on what are family traditions, the national traditions, that is clearly, it only is going to serve the far right. And I think that is part of the problem that we're in right now. And so I almost thought maybe Monday, when we saw the Interior Minister say that, you know, quite early on, they knew that it was a young Afghan, potentially Pakistani, as we might have found out later in the week, and a teenager. That was quite new. So it suggests to me that maybe something has turned in the way these stories are communicated, but also the type of, I would say, domestic diplomacy that the German state has to do amongst its population.
Steve, we have an interview coming up with the mayor of Cologne, and it's extraordinary, the interview. She says, you know, that when the attacks, the New Year's Eve attacks happened, not only was the information slow to get to her, the police just didn't tell her a huge amount of information about the attacks, and she was unable to do her job, in a sense, because of this kind of inbuilt fear of talking about migration, as Tyler says.
It's extraordinary. I mean, I think it's... I think part of the story actually is interesting with the mayor there, is it shows how these things, how important relationships are here. You know, she partly also wasn't told because she didn't have a very good relationship with the old male police chief who saw her as the new mayor and perhaps wasn't comfortable, wasn't willing to give her as much information as she needed. But I think, you know, there is in some ways an understandable desire to be careful with some information if you think that actually that's going to lead to a racist backlash, and we've seen that in some places where that has happened. But I think it just makes things worse if you aren't upfront and you don't say this is what happened, this is who did it, or this is who we believe has done it, and then also you follow through a course of, you know, obviously apprehending that person and putting them on trial.
Tyler, can I bring back, and we wanted to broaden this conversation. We know that there have been deadly attacks in France, deadly attacks in Belgium, where many, many scores of people have lost their lives. Even despite this potential, we'll wait to see whether it is a terrorism attack today. Even despite everything that's happened in Germany over the last week, the numbers who have been hurt and injured and killed are minuscule in comparison. Is there a kind of an urban story here to be told? Because we know that in France, in Brussels, many of the people who come to these cities, you know, not only do they not integrate, there's no need for them to even kind of, you know, bump up against the state at all, because they're in banlieue, they're in kind of ghetto areas. Germany seems to have done something more interesting. It does seem to place these people when they arrive within the city. So for good or bad, they're a little bit more forced to, you know, become part of the city. They're a little bit forced in some instances to be watched and to be, you know, part of the community. Why is it, do you think, there has been this difference between France and Germany?
I think, you know, part of it, and this sounds a little bit absurd, but people will probably appreciate it, flying on a Friday afternoon, there's a way that many German airports will behave versus being in French airports. You know, there is a cultural component of just dealing with, and, you know, I hate to use the word logistics around humanity, but a part of it was that, Andrew, we were witness to it. We were on a train from Vienna to Munich last autumn, really at the height of that weekend when the story and this human wave really started to reach the heart of Europe. And you saw that it was quite remarkable. And you hate to sort of use the word processing and also Germany and humanity in the same sentence. But that's what it was, and it was in an efficient way, and it was seemingly in a very humane way as well. And of course, the Merkel government ran up immediately, and not just with Bavaria, but with many states in the country. This question of listen, how are we going to deal with that? But and now where are we? We're coming up to almost 1 year later, 11 months later. And sure, there are problems in many corners of Germany, but there are many more success stories as well in terms of how people have been dealt with. We know that there's language shortages, et cetera, but there is a concerted effort to get people, and also sort of a little bit late breaking news as well, not just getting people into language classes, but getting people into employment. And we've seen a series of changes just over the last few weeks. A lot of pressure from very small towns saying, well, listen, if we don't want people begging in front of grocery stores, what can we do for them? We need to get them into the system. And now it's quite interesting in Germany, they're not even just looking at getting people on the ladder by speaking German, but also English as well. A big debate right now as to whether English becomes the first language. I don't think that's going to happen. But there is just a very, very different sense than, of course, what we've seen as the current French model. And again, also in terms of immigration numbers, not dealing, of course, with the same wave that Germany's had.
Tom, what is your take on this? Because it is fascinating. Again, on the liberal side, you get caught up in like, oh, we haven't done enough to integrate people. And sometimes enough has been done and people don't want those opportunities or want to follow a different path, or there's something psychological added to the story as well. But what do you think is the difference between the French state and it's interesting hearing Tyler talk there about Germany, that practicality, that okay, here's the three steps you need to do to get these people into the society and a little bit kind of safer and away from the risk of being drawn into terrorism. France maybe has been a little bit more laissez-faire about things. But what's your take on those two different cultures?
Well, I wonder if it's because France is more kind of ideologically explicit, if you like, about its very inclusiveness. And in a way, again, there's a bitter irony there, which is that maybe is causing the fact that people feel excluded. It makes that more profound, whether this is the way that it's so aggressively secular or respects like that. What I think is interesting is for the domestic populations as well. Tyler talked about people being fearful in certain ways. I think Steve mentioned it earlier. It's about managing fear when we look at what the nation states need to do here. And I think one of the problems is, Tyler mentioned it in Germany, actually, there's a lot of good news stories there. You see it even in the US at the moment, that the United States is very safe, it's pretty economically secure, but you're seeing people peddling narratives about fearfulness. And I think that we need to address people's legitimate fears. And going right back to what Steve was saying at the top of the program, I think one of the ways that you do that is to be absolutely candid and straight with people. And I think there's lessons probably for all Western liberal democracies about how they talk to their communities, whether that's recent arrivals or the people who've been here for generations.
Well, it's a story we know that we're going to be covering for one reason or another, in depth for many more months to come. It's the story of terrorism and how we report it, and really the narrative of how we cope with it. But we're going to move on now, because it's also been a chaotic week in Turkey. Last Friday, the nation suffered a failed coup initiated by a faction within its military. And throughout the week, reprisals from the country's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, have seen thousands arrested, investigated and suspended from roles ranging from the police to academia. Now, let's hear a recap of some of the stories we've heard coming from Turkey in the past week across global media, and also from our own bureau chief in Istanbul, Chris Lord.
What we know so far is that there's been an attempt by a portion of the military. It's not clear how much of the military has actually taken part in this, but an attempt by groups within the military to take control of the country.
Death toll from that attempted coup now stands at 60. Also hearing that 336 people have been detained in connection with that attack.
This morning, more than 10,000 people are now been detained across Turkey, and that's all sectors, from the education service to the military to the judicial service. And really, it's all part of this Turkey's claims that the coup has this Gulenist plot behind it. So this is the exiled cleric Fethullah Gulen. Lots of people now are asking what happens next, because at the moment the government is keeping everybody happy with, you know, promises of democracy and so on. But when those people have to realise what a state of emergency actually means when it comes to governance, I think there's going to be a real serious concerns. And then the big one, of course, the massive concern for everybody here, is the economy.
Steve, where do we stand 1 week after that failed coup, do you think?
What's been quite interesting is all day today I've been recording the foreign desk for tomorrow on Turkey. And normally, you know, we have lots of different guests that we're considering who to choose from and so on, and lots of people to speak to. Here we had a number of people that would normally have spoken to us inside Turkey who were too afraid to do that. And that's the thing where I think we are right now. There is a sense of fear within Turkey about speaking out against the government in any way whatsoever. And that is slightly worrying. There are two things that happened last weekend in putting down the coup. People came out in support of Erdogan, and they came out in support of democracy. Now, some people came out in support of both. Some people came out in support of one and definitely not the other. And I think it'll be interesting in the weeks and months ahead which one of those things becomes more dominant. And my fear is it is Erdogan, not democracy.
Tom, it's interesting, as Steve says, you know, because many on the liberal side of the country, or the people who have been not really supporters of Erdogan in any sense at all, they came out as well. They felt that actually, you know, a dictatorship going back to a military regime would be terrible for them. But despite their support, you know, for not having a military regime, it looks like many of those will be concerned about events and the direction, the suspension of human rights, the imposition of, you know, of a state of emergency.
Well, yeah, I mean, and not only the fact that those things are happening, but that Erdogan is so explicit and brazen in describing his motivations and describing the people that he's sort of targeting in his counter to action. I mean, it's funny, Steve and I were talking earlier about the response around the world, and it was interesting that even Erdogan's, I guess it would be hard, a push to call them critics, but people who are maybe not, don't see eye to eye with him, were far more explicit in condemning the coup attempt than, for example, a number of quite prominent Western politicians who were very mealy-mouthed about what they said.
His first comment, Boris Johnson, the new UK Foreign Secretary, was very concerned about the situation and was a message for Brits in Turkey of how to get in touch with their embassy. There was no call for the, you know, for the army to stand down. There was no support for Erdogan. Again, John Kerry talked about stability, democracy, and I think it was, and continuity. Again, it wasn't explicit in a way that had there been a coup in, you know, another NATO ally, those nations would have been very strongly in there saying, this isn't on, we support the elected government.
Tom, although he doesn't have a huge amount of support, maybe among some kind of Western leaders, and maybe we look with concern about the, you know, the speed of which, you know, all these institutions are being cleansed, a sense that he knew well in advance that if he ever had the day, who he'd get rid of. If there was a military coup in any other country, it's kind of fair enough, isn't it? You change the order. Why is it that we're so concerned about what he's doing?
Well, I think it's because it plays into a pre-existing narrative, as much as this plays into Erdogan's own narrative about blaming certain dissident clerics or members of the military establishment or the business establishment, as he has done. This played into an existing narrative that Erdogan was aggressive. He, you know, was challenging the legitimacy of international institutions, that he was sort of being confrontational with the whole of the European bloc, actually, whilst on the one hand continuing to, you know, restate his belief that Turkey ultimately should accede to join the EU, whilst at the same time challenging, in the same way that, you know, with his remarks about bringing back the death penalty, for example, he knows how antagonistic that is as a message to people who he would otherwise have presumably been wanting the support of in saying we shouldn't see military coups. So it played into existing notions about what Erdogan was like as a contrarian and as a sort of an aggressive politician, if you like.
And just finally, Steve, on this story, do you think that, you know, in the end, one of the checks on him may be, you know, that, you know, we have, you know, an airline, a tourism industry, all sorts of industries flowing from Turkey that are dependent on it being, you know, a nice place to go to, friendly, helpful, a useful conduit. In the end, although he may want to kind of make many regime changes, if you want to survive, you can't sweep away all of those kind of things that make people think it's a good place to go to.
Yes, but there is a difference between stability and democracy. And I think that, you know, the airline, the, you know, the major businesses, the tourism industry will, you know, will want to see stability over democracy if they're faced with the choice between those two. You know, we only have to look at, you know, if we're looking at airlines, you know, Emirates or Etihad, there's no pressure there for, you know, Abu Dhabi or Dubai to be democracies. I think the key thing will be is, does it feel as if it's stable and is the economy strong? And if those two things are the case, then democracy, you know, may not have as much support as from those communities as we would like. But the interesting thing will be is, you know, what happens next in terms of Erdogan's attempts to create a more executive presidency, a stronger presidency. You know, he tried to do that in the past. He didn't get the support from the public. My sense is from talking to people all throughout the past week is, were he to ask again right now, were there to be an election tomorrow, he would get enough support to change the constitution to make his presidency stronger.
Now, who knew, but nuclear submarines are going to be our light story at the end of this report, because Britain has some nuclear submarines, where it's renewing its Trident nuclear defence programme. But one of the UK's subs, called the Ambush, the largest and the most advanced nuclear-powered sub in the Royal Navy, has managed to crash into a merchant vessel off the coast of Gibraltar this week. The damage to both ships was described as superficial, but the Ambush's reactor was apparently also not affected. But with each sub costing the nation over £1 billion each, this is the kind of gaffe that you should expect. Tom, a silly story in a way, but it shows, you know, that when we think about nuclear deterrence and their secrecy and them being under the surface all the time, they are actually just run by ordinary sailors who can make mistakes.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if that fills me with a tremendous amount of confidence, to be honest. I kind of think some things are more important than just the sort of, oh, well, you know, win some, lose some rationale. There's several things about this, of course. It plays into a broader discussion about, you know, the whole UK's nuclear defences, which, of course, was approved this week, but is very controversial. And the costs, which, you know, in a country that's still, you know, there's a great deal of uncertainty going forwards. There's still, you know, the hallmarks of austerity over the last few years. Should we be spending, you know, many billions? I also don't understand why each of our submarines costs, by some measure of multiplication, that much more than, for example, the new US submarines. Maybe we just don't know how to strike a procurement deal anymore. But there's lots of things about it that worry me, and the fact that they can't steer them under a ship above them is probably top of the list.
But it was also interesting that there's unconfirmed reports that these were being helmed, shall we say, by trainees. Now, you know, obviously you've got to learn at some stage. It's, you know, everyone needs to get up to speed.
It's now a simulator is for that, Steve.
yes, one would hope that would be the case.
We're just going to go back to our top story this evening, which was the shooting that we know has been happening in Munich this evening, or that happened in Munich this evening. We're hearing that the police are advising people to avoid open spaces and stay indoors. There was a report earlier on that potentially the gunman had got away and had got onto the U-Bahn. Reports are that staff are still hiding inside the shopping centre, and also that transport services have all been halted. Now, we're just going to quickly cross back to Tyler Brulé, editor-in-chief, who's in northern Italy. And Tyler, I know you've been following what's being put up on the German media sites as well. Do you have any extra kind of news for us on this?
Just that a large area, we're talking about a mall, which is in the area, of course, which hosted the Olympics. And this, in a broader area, is completely now in lockdown. And this is, according to Bayerischer Rundfunk, the state broadcaster, part of the broader ARD network, and that, yeah, the gunman is at large at this point. Massive police operation ongoing. And I'll just say a very interesting story there as well, which is also blowing up, which is the fact that a great failing on the part of also German authorities with regard to the gunman, or the attacker, I should say, from earlier this week, that actually they don't even know who this person is. Quite remarkable story that the ARD has come across now, which is this is really going to, I think, hit the pages over the weekend. No fingerprints. They didn't do any photography. They had to go back to Hungary because Hungary did it. So you can imagine also what that means. But also just an interesting piece of reporting there.
Well, Tyler, thank you very much for joining us. We're just coming in to come back into the studio. Tom, you've just been watching the story as well unfold. Any more takes on this for us?
The BBC reports that police have apparently told German media that there are several deaths in the Munich shopping centre shooting. But as Steve said, this is still such a confused and fractured picture. There's very little of clarity emerging still at this moment, unfortunately.
And we must make it clear at this point that we have not, as we said, had any confirmation of who the attackers are. We do not know for sure that this is even a terrorist attack. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening to Midori House, and thank you very much to our producers tonight, to Rhys and to Tom Hall. We'll be following this with a news bulletin at the top of the hour, bringing you more details. But from me, Andrew Tuck, good night, and thank you for listening.